Should we buy organic or not? Should we limit ourselves to eating only locally grown food? These are just a few of the dilemmas consumers face when they consider how to approach ethical, sustainable, and healthy eating. In his new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, James E. McWilliams argues that the answer to responsible eating lies somewhere in what he calls the pragmatic center of two extremes. The book is published by Back Bay Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings James McWilliams to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You write that Just Food is a very personal book for you. What makes it personal?
Well, it's personal in that I underwent a transformation of my own. Several years ago, I was actively involved in the locavore movement and found myself slowly becoming, suffocated might be too strong of a word, but acutely aware of the isolationism of the movement and the tendency towards elitism. And this led me to start asking some questions that, while I still maintain tremendous respect for many of the movement's goals, I've learned how to put it in a kind of global perspective that's made me think about food and agriculture in very different ways than I did as recently as 5 or 6 years ago.
In what ways is it elitist?
Well, I think we're looking at a movement that works very well for a certain socioeconomic class in that the kinds of methods that are used to grow food locally or organically are, in many cases, more environmentally sound. Not always, but sometimes. And that's expensive, and that's going to lead to higher-priced food. So, you know, we can say that in historical perspective, we haven't spent so little on food in, you know, the history of the United States, but that doesn't matter if you're working a couple jobs and trying to make ends meet. You don't want your food prices to go up.
Well, if you speak to someone like Alice Waters, one of the people you're critical of here, she will say we have it's a matter of priorities. Either you buy those expensive sneakers or you buy a flat screen TV or you spend the money on better food. And our bodies are very important.
And I couldn't disagree with that in a theoretical sense. I think Waters is absolutely right that it is a matter of priorities. And I mean, we can all sort of rationally calculate how we spend our money and say, hey, you know what, we could do this in a lot better way. But the pragmatics of that, I think, as anyone, you know, who sits down and tries to do this occasionally knows, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult sell to tell people that they should spend more on food. And so I don't think that's a battle I want to take on.
Don't most of the world's great cuisines, French, Spanish, Italian, Mexican, Chinese, insist on using locally produced ingredients?
Not necessarily.
Well, my experience in Europe, for example, has been that the stuff you're eating usually came from just over the hill in Italy, for example. A restaurant in France, it's likely if it's a decent restaurant, the chef has just gone out and cut the herbs that are being put into tonight's food.
Maybe the herbs, but if you want to break down the overall ingredient list of any restaurant, I mean, there's going to be a global aspect to it. And I think what we experience as consumers a lot of time is a pretty hard sell on the terroir or on the local or on the kind of organic aspect of what we're eating, when in fact what's hidden is a kind of vast global network that we tend to look at with a certain amount of skepticism, and perhaps legitimately so. But at the same time, I think we have to be aware that, you know, globalism and global trade has provided us with an enormous access to a wide array of fruits and vegetables and other foods that we wouldn't normally have. And one quick point about, you know, the Italian example is the ingredients may indeed be local, but the labor isn't. The labor is coming from North Africa and creating all kinds of problems. So, you know, when we think about food, I think we have to keep that global dimension in mind.
Is that something that the proponents of local food, like Alice Waters, Michael Pollan, and Wendell Berry, are missing?
I would say that they're missing it. And, I mean, I want to be very careful here because I think what Waters and Berry and Pollan have done is raise popular awareness about food, unlike anybody in the history of the United States has ever done. It's a very positive thing. But what I argue in my book is we have to be able to balance the local perspective with a much broader perspective that takes into consideration questions like labor, that takes into consideration questions such as, you know, what would happen if I took my, you know, rather seemingly environmentally responsible diet and scaled it up? What if everyone ate the way that I ate? And I find that with a lot of the local prescriptions, if you do that, you run into some trouble.
I was just talking to two local farmers, and one of the things that Annie said was, if you're planting carrots, why not plant a purple carrot rather than an orange one? Because we are losing so many of the varieties as we specialize. You say that people who want heirloom tomatoes, I guess carrots would also be in that category, doing the world more harm than good.
Oh, I don't know that I said they would be doing harm. I think the issue has to be looked at in these terms. Genetic diversity is critically important, and a diversity of heirloom tomatoes and carrots is wonderful. But priorities. Let's get back to that issue of priorities. Right now, we are looking at a population growth of 3 billion people by 2050. And therefore, when I look at an effort to decentralize the food supply, bring it down to a smaller scale, focusing on genetic diversity with often pre-industrial methods, I ask myself, is that what we need right now? I mean, maybe we should wait until the population plateaus and then start taking on these endeavors. But, you know, right now, it's a dangerous proposition, I think, to focus on the kind of boutique concerns when we have to produce a lot of calories on the same amount of land. Double the amount of calories on the same amount of land by 2050.
Is it just boutique-y? Studies suggest that people who shop at farmers markets have 10 times the conversations that they do in the supermarket. And Michael Pollan has even called them the new town square. Isn't the culture of farmers markets as important as supporting small agriculture?
Americans are extremely alienated right now from nature, and we need a balm for that alienation. And I think farmers markets have served that purpose quite well. As a historian, which I am by training, I'm not entirely convinced that markets are the place where communities are built. My experience in studying markets in the 17th and 18th century shows that it's a place where people fight as much as they form communal bonds. I mean, there's a number of ways that we can build community ties, and farmers markets are certainly one of them. But again, I'm not necessarily sure I'm going to place these larger global concerns behind community development in a place that is already doing pretty well. Here we are in the first world.
Michelle Obama is pledging to end child obesity in a generation and to end food deserts in 7 years. Couldn't local food help alleviate food deserts? Haven't we been creating them to some degree as we destroy farms and put houses on them?
Well, a lot of the advocates of local food make their arguments from places where it's very easy to have a diversity of local foods. And, you know, much of the country, you can't do that and enjoy the kind of diversity that we enjoy right now and enjoy the affordability of food that we enjoy right now. So, yeah, I mean, there are certainly going to be examples where growing locally or encouraging, you know, small community gardens can help alleviate the food deserts. But the obesity issue, I also want to add, that's a problem that's very difficult to fix. And we're talking about deep socioeconomic and cultural concerns that I'm not entirely sure can be dealt with from the top down.
You live in Austin, Texas. Can your experience in Austin be used as a way of thinking about food in the rest of the country? For example, New York has the Hudson Valley. San Francisco has a lot of wonderful farmland around it. Los Angeles does as well. Austin, Texas does not, if I remember correctly. Driving through large parts of Texas, you don't see very much farmland.
No, you could live on a steady diet of beef. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, and certainly I belong to a CSA. I get food delivered to my porch once a week, and it's a lot of root vegetables, and it's a lot of monotony. And, you know, on the one hand, I'm happy to be supporting the local farmers. But I would also add here that local, quote-unquote local in Texas, can be from 400 miles away. It's from within the state. So,
and you put much emphasis on food miles in your critique of locavorism.
One thing that I've noticed is that a lot of consumers, very concerned, ethically oriented consumers, are asking a question, how far did my food travel? And the answer to that question becomes a kind of proxy for environmentalism. If it just traveled 20 miles, well, then this food is certainly much more energy efficient than food that came from, you know, 1,000 miles away. And that's not always the case. When you do a full life cycle analysis of much of the food that we eat, it turns out that the transportation costs are about 10% of the overall energy cost. So by focusing on food miles, we may be missing the larger source of energy waste, which is in the production phase.
And then there are certain things that we can't avoid shipping, like citrus fruits to New York City, because we can't grow them here.
No, you can't. And if you did, it would require an enormous amount of energy because you'd have to fabricate the geographical geographical conditions in order to do that. And this happens often with things like tomatoes. I mean, we grow hothouse tomatoes, and the amount of energy it takes to do that is enormous. And buying it locally wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if you could get it grown naturally from, you know, South America.
Well, I have tomatoes growing in my on my deck, and I have to tell you, they taste a lot better than the stuff that gets shipped in from South America.
And I'm sure they do. And, I mean, taste is a whole other category here. And absolutely, if my concerns were strictly with the taste of our food, I probably would be more of a locavore than I am right now. But again, I want to emphasize that I'm concerned with producing enough calories to keep people well-fed for the next 50 years before the population levels off.
My guest is James E. McWilliams. His book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, published by Back Bay Books. It's interesting that this book comes out not long after Foreign Policy magazine ran an article in February with the title, How Locavores Could Save the World. And their argument is that local food cuts down on emissions from transporting foods and reduces chemicals in the soil.
The issue there with the chemicals in agriculture has very little to do with local food, and it has everything to do with what we're eating rather than where it came from. If you want to do an analysis of where chemicals are used in agriculture, you will find that an overwhelming majority of those chemicals are used in one way or another to support the meat industry. And, you know, I have a whole chapter in my book on this. 99% of the food that we eat in this country is from factory-raised meat. And the chemicals that it requires to grow the feed in order to feed those animals and bring them to slaughter weight very quickly accounts for the majority of the antibiotics that are used in this country. I mean, I won't barrage you with statistics, but you get my point.
Well, isn't eating less meat part of the locavore ethos?
Not to my knowledge. I have found that my interaction with locavores goes more along the lines of I can choose alternative sources of meat, such as grass-fed beef. And I think this is where the elitism comes back in. Grass-fed beef is much more expensive. It's not something that the average consumer chooses to do or can do. And ultimately—
But doesn't that undermine what you just said? Because grass-fed beef, if we went back to that, which all beef was grass-fed beef for a long time, if we went back to grass-fed beef, then we wouldn't have the whole problem of growing all of this grain in these factory farms.
You would have the problem of decimating rainforests in order to grow grass to feed the animals. If we didn't lower our meat consumption, if we continued in this country to eat 273 pounds of meat a year and just made it all grass-fed, where's the land going to come for that? And so this is what I meant earlier by, you know, if you make a dietary choice, I think it's worthwhile to universalize it and ask what the effects would be. On average, it takes 8 to 10 acres per grass-fed cow to bring it to weight. And as grass-fed beef becomes more important, methane emissions go up. They emit 3 to 4 times more methane than conventionally raised cows. And a lot of grass-fed growers are actually fertilizing grass, undermining the whole point of removing the chemicals to begin with.
Well, in my conversations with many of the people who you're being critical of, they all talk about cutting down on our red meat consumption. And somebody like Mark Bittman says he's a vegetarian until 6 o'clock in the evening as a way of controlling things. Many others talk about going back to older ways where meat is really more of a flavoring than the dominant thing on the plate. This is something that this is a problem we Americans have created for ourselves through factory farms.
Yeah, to a point. And Bittman is, you know, he's a hero of mine for that. Of the food writers out there, he has really taken on this meat issue in a way that I really appreciate. You know, we are talking about meat consumption in the United States. And, of course, the real issue is meat consumption in India and China. If we export our meat-based diet, then we're going to face real problems.
Another argument of the people you're critical of is that much of the factory-grown stuff is subsidized by the government, but organic food is not subsidized. And if we had an equal amount of it wouldn't be so expensive.
Very good point. And my last chapter
would be eating better food.
My last chapter is on subsidies, and absolutely. I mean, the system that we are a victim of, the industrial system, I think can work. I am not an opponent of industrial food per se. I oppose how it's structured and driven by subsidies right now. What would happen if we pulled the subsidies out? Dramatic things would happen. You couldn't afford to produce the meat that's being produced right now. And you'd see more vegetable consumption, more whole grain consumption. I don't know if you'd see more organic food consumption. That would be fine. But there would be tremendous environmental benefits and health benefits to be gained in this country just by switching from meat more to whole grains, more to lentils, more to fruits and vegetables. So it's really that transition that I think would be overwhelmingly positive. And if that included some organic food, that's great. I have no problem with organic food as one element amongst other forms of production and consumption.
You suggest that genetically modified foods can be a part of the equation. Don't some scientists worry that genetic contamination might result? And we've had a recent Supreme Court case involving a ban on GMO alfalfa because of those concerns.
It's a major concern, and it is one that I think the industry is starting to take very seriously. And I think GMOs, it's a minefield, and it's very difficult to kind of split the hairs quickly here. But just let me say that there are potential humanitarian and environmental applications of that technology that we are not seeing because there's so much opposition to the really unfortunate way that the technology is being applied right now, which is to grow three major crops monoculturally to feed to animals and ethanol plants.
A lot of corn.
Oh, I think 90% of corn in this country is GMO corn, and with soy, it's close to the same. So there are potentially much more beneficial applications of this technology. Drift, absolutely, it's a concern. Any agricultural technology is going to have drawbacks, and this is another thing that has kind of soured me a bit on the locavore movement, is there is a sense that we can grow food without an impact. We need to grow food according to the way nature intended to grow food. Nature didn't intend to grow food for us. It's about human intervention into nature to make it produce calories for it. And by definition, there are going to be costs.
How much of this is philosophical and how much of it is political?
This debate. Oh, wow. This debate is religious. It's political. It's metaphysical. I mean, one of the things that I really underestimated talking about this book was just how food is – it's integral to our identity. So it is all of the above. And I think that one of the things I've learned as I've talked more and more about my book is really to be aware of that. But when you're talking about somebody's food choices, you're talking about their identity.
My guest, James E. McWilliams, is an associate professor of history at Texas State University, San Marcos. He received the 2009 Hyatt Prize in the Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. His book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, is published by Back Bay Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.